Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show peeking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist and birthday girl, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Hello.
And happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Winter. Happy birthday to you.
And Ragnarok.
Thank you. No longer subject to copyright. Take that, two ladies who wrote it. Winter, we have a beautiful array of lovelinesses to enjoy because it's your birthday.
Thank you, guys. It really made the difference.
Karen got some snacks and things, but one of the things she got, Girl Scout cookies, it is the season. Right. What is your Girl Scout cookie of choice?
Shortbread.
Oh, okay.
I can take down an entire box in one sitting, which is so embarrassing to admit.
It's bland and not compelling. which is the least you thing on the planet.
I know. Zig and I zag.
Sometimes you want a beautiful basic.
Exactly.
We've also got journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hello there, Guy. Winter, I just want you to know that I was going to get you like a real white girl flower crown for your birthday, but it just didn't happen.
Thank you.
Next time you go to Coachella.
I was hoping for a Little House on the Prairie dress, but that's even better, so thank you.
I fucking love a flower crown.
I do too, deep down inside.
Margaret,
yes,
Girl Scout cookie of choice.
Anything with peanut butter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I don't mess with the other ones so much. Although a good frozen Thin Mint, I can deal with that.
So those are Do-Si-Dos in part of the country and peanut butter patties in another part of the country.
That's correct.
I believe. I could be wrong.
And then there's the other little like sandwich guys.
Yes.
Yeah, that are kind of dry. You need to have like a good glass of milk or something with it.
I don't care for peanut butter.
And you're wrong.
And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Tongson.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, how's your week going?
It's going wonderfully, and I was going to say the Girl Scout cookie box that we brought actually is going to feature a naked Ben Affleck jumping out of it for Winter on her birthday.
Oh, that's exciting.
He's shrunk down. He's downsized.
I hope nothing else is downsized.
Karen,
gross everybody out?
What is your Girl Scout cookie of choice?
I brought it. Samoas.
Samoas is the correct answer. Karen scores the points.
Right.
Coming up on this week's show, we each assigned each other some movies. It ended up getting a little convoluted, but the point is, it's awards season. There were some like big hitters out there that each of us hadn't seen, and so we each assigned somebody else a movie to watch, and we're going to talk about those titles. Should I say what they are?
No, let's like make them wake.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are already listening to this podcast. Keep involved. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret, what's your middle name?
Louise.
All right!
Margaret Louise Wappler.
Say it with a southern accent if you
Margaret, could. Margaret Louise Wappler. I was wondering what your all about this week was.
Well, now, that's all I'm going to do with that. I watched Velvet Buzzsaw, which has been making some waves. It's one of the Netflix original movies. It's starring Jake Gyllenhaal as a persnickety, uptight art critic in the most delicious pair of horn-rimmed glasses and all the accoutrement that you expect from your local art critic. And it's a interesting movie because it marries a few different genres. It's like horror, it's satire, it's about the art world, it's supernatural. What happens in the movie is that Jake Gyllenhaal befriends or rather gets involved with an ambitious gallery assistant who stumbles upon this trove of artwork from a deceased neighbor of hers. And it's like really dark, disturbing, creepy paintings, but they're very mesmerizing. Like everyone who lays eyes on them are like, oh my God, I have to have this. And it becomes through the efforts of this art assistant and who's played by Zawe Ashton and she's really good. And also Renee Russo.
Welcome back, Renee.
I know. Yeah. I'm so happy to see her back. Like, not that she's really been like gone, but it's just been a while. She plays what to me is like one of the most LA characters I can think of that has never been really committed to film properly, which is like the punk, like the like authentic punk vixen turned cutthroat gallerist.
What was so wonderful about it is it felt like Renee Russo was given back to us after all of those years working backwards in high heels while some dude was in a dude's movie.
Yes.
To have her as like a crinkly, weird, like so specific, so many textures character was like, what are we going to do with this bitch now?
Yes, and that bitch basically gets the artwork of this deceased neighbor. She turns it into the toast of the town. Like, everybody's got to have this guy's paintings. But of course, the paintings are like haunted and they begin to curse the people who take them and try to make money off of them. And basically, the movie is worth the price of admission alone for like Jake Gyllenhaal's wonderful gestures as like this really kind of like uptight, snooty little art critic. He's kind of like, I really think about Emily Blunt's character in The Devil Wears Prada. Uh-huh. Like, it's got some elements of that, but like if she had an art PhD, you know? Another thing I really loved about the movie is the kind of like little details that happen in it, the little details that are from the art world and are particularly about the art world now. In fact, I think Dan Gilroy, the director, writer of the movie, could have had more of these, but he has Toni Collette in one of the scenes, and she's on fire in this movie. Like, she's just having a great time. She's got this like platinum wig that she's constantly shaking around, and she's playing this sort of like Mocha-esque curator turned sellout, like art advisor to the rich. And the way, like, I can't give it away, but let me just say that the way she passes on to the next world, I don't know how to not spoil, I mean, you know what's going to happen to her, but the way
passes
that it
passes on to the next realm.
That's
passes
not
on
a
to the
next.
That itself sounds like an art history major.
Like, passes on in the next museum in the sky, whatever, I don't know. She, basically the way it goes down is just really hilarious and brilliant and very funny. And it's like, it's not a perfect movie. It could have been sharper, but the moments that crack really crack.
Winter Mitchell.
Oh my gosh.
On this, your name day, what is your all about?
My all about is also from Netflix, and it's Russian Doll. Russian Doll is Natasha Lyonne's semi-autobiographical journey through her maybe a couple decades long addiction. It's more like a Groundhog's Day, except people say that and they're immediately turned off because Groundhog's Day is annoying. But
no, it's not. It's one of the best comedies we've got.
But you don't want to see, but you've seen that trope.
That
a
was
few
a
times.
Quick turn for
I
you
know.
Winner. You're like, I agree.
I don't agree. It takes that and sort of turns it on its nose and really starts exploring. It goes beyond that. The first episode or two kind of goes down, you know, she dies, you know, live, die, repeat. But then she starts taking a journey into like what she's doing. And instead of like doing that typical thing, like, I got to right the wrongs so I can stop dying, she actually starts taking like not only philosophical, but like spiritual journeys with everybody she's interacting in the course of living, dying, and repeating. And taking a journey that is more in depth, more involved, more committed, more, you know, and really seeing the people that she's interacting with.
An emotional
with.
Sicario, if you
yes!
will.
Yes! Guy! And it was, you know, look, you can watch it on Netflix and it's great. And I kind of gave you the gist and there's a lot of articles online about it. I really want to talk about how Natasha Lyonne, Slums of Beverly Hills, the first movie, you know, that was her debut, her film debut. God, she's an amazing actress. She's always committed. She's always just doing the work, as Guy says. But she had a turn there in her 20s and early 30s before she went into Orange is the New Black, where she was, you know, addicted to drugs. She was doing a lot of stuff that caught headlines, had a lot of slip ups with the law and near-death experiences. And I think what it bring, those experiences, she's sober now, but those experiences bring to this character something that I just find completely refreshing. You don't see many women get the opportunity to have a second act, a third act, and actually have the ability to act and also be able to be honest about what their bullshit is. She's very aware and honest and talks about it in many, as recently as this Elle article, is very upfront and honest about, you know, I almost died multiple times and I had to pull my shit together and now I'm awake and aware and present. And I think that it's very interesting to see someone who is an addict, even when you're sober, you're still an addict, who can talk actively about being present and aware and being a participant. I always thought that I was the first person to say being a participant in my own life, but she talked a lot in this Elle article about participating in her life in a way that she never did before. And it's very evident. You see the growth. You see the maturity. You still see the same, like, spunky, raspy-voiced character, but she's just so good in this.
I think that one thing about the... I was concerned when the show started.
Because Bernhoff did.
Yeah, because I was concerned because I was like, okay, there's this little trope, you got to get up by Harry Nelson, like, you know, repeating over and over again. It's a great song, but at the same time, you're like, and then you have Natasha Lyonne doing what in my mind is sort of like her, like, post-millennial version of Estelle Getty, Golden Girls, you know, and this kind of scrappy character with lots of moxie. But then the show does divert and take these turns and curves right around the end of episode three. And then once, like, episode four hit, I got through the first three episodes very slowly.
Yeah.
But then, like, you kind of get over the end of episode three hump, and then suddenly, like, I just binged the whole thing and couldn't stop. And, yeah, I was, like, super into it.
Yeah.
Karen, do you have something that you were all about this week?
I do.
It's all right, Karen, if you don't. It's perfectly fine.
Some weeks it's just like, what? What do I do with myself? But this week, actually, I was pleasantly surprised. And it may be because this show happened to, like, synergize with the unit that I'm teaching in my pop culture class. We're in the 80s right now. Ooh. And we just covered, before I even watched it, we covered Wall Street and the Black Monday crash in 1987.
Wall Street, the movie?
Well, just Wall Street and Greed, but we actually watched Working Girl.
Yes! So
let the river run.
My All About is neither Wall Street nor is it Working Girl, but it is a perfect amalgamation of all things 80s, and it is a show that's actually about the Black Monday stock market crash in October 19th, 1987, the most devastating stock market crash in history in the U.S., and it's a new Showtime series starring John Cheadle as Mo Monroe, who's a sort of renegade on Wall Street, like, kind of taking on the blue blood firms like the Lehman Brothers, basically that kind of maverick spirit that you see lionized in a lot of contemporary accounts of Wall Street these days, your Wolves of Wall Street kind of thing. And, you know, there are all sorts of great folks in it. Regina Hall is Don Darcy. Andrew Rannells is this guy named Blair. There's a whole riff in the first episode about, you're a dude named Blair. and the thing, it has every sort of gratifying, saturated 80s referentiality in it. You've got a great rhythm of the night pun. And, like, use of you just got debarged, you know? I don't know. I think I was predisposed to it.
And it was made for you.
It was made exactly for me. Made for this moment in my life. And it really is about the whole year leading up to the Black Monday crash, because people did not know what caused this devastating crash in the stock market. And this sort of works from this kind of speculative place, a kind of, like, sort of true story about the year and the events that eventually destroyed Wall Street in that particular moment. Anyway, I think it's a fun show worth watching.
I am also about something that is on your television. I am all about the fact that Schitt's Creek has returned.
Ooh.
Have any of you opened up a relationship with Schitt's Creek at all?
Of course we have.
I'm delinquent.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm delinquent. I'm now the only panelist.
Winter
who
dropped
has
Schitt's Creek 2 years ago on this show.
I dropped a lot of shit in that creek.
Is that show it takes a while to figure out what it's doing.
Yes.
But I don't know that there is a show that has continued to evolve and grow as time has gone on as much as that show. A couple of weekends ago, I was at Sketchfest, and the great Julia Duffy from Newhart was there.
Oh, my God.
And I got a chance to just sort of, like, being me, I was like, I'm going to ask you three questions. And one of them was, it was basically like, what have we lost when it comes to sitcom writing? Mm-hmm. And having her talk about, like, the ways that they approach Newhart, watching this new season of Schitt's Creek, I realized it really is in the tradition of Newhart. These people, like, dropped in this ridiculous little world. And there is something so deeply Canadian about the respect that the show has for all parties involved.
Yes.
That however much John and Moira and David and Alexis may be ridiculous and idiots, they still love each other. And that the people who, they get to gawk at how ridiculous these townies are, and the townies get to gawk back at them.
But they coexist.
And they have a sense of dignity and respect for each other. Annie Murray's work as Alexis is just astounding to me. Because, of course, you know, like Eugene Levy and
Dan
are related. Like, they've been working with Catherine O'Hara forever. And to have this interloper figure out how to create a physicality that works with them is amazing. And also, if you don't understand why you should like this show, just go for, like, Catherine. Like, just go for Moira Rose's pronunciation of things. The way she says the word enchilada is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. In season 3 or 4, there's a man named Herb Ertlinger who has a winery, and it is like a Chekhov gun that is laid down, and you are just waiting for when she's slightly too drunk and has to say Herb Ertlinger over and over again, and what she'll be able to do. But, like, everyone on that show does ridiculously good work. It manages to feel biting without being, like, it is mean. I think it is a show that is mean but has a heart.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of comedy that I do, so it's a kind of comedy that I like. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about movies we missed in the theater because we have busy lives after this.
Greetings. I am Plek Dexsetter, contacting you from the Zik Squadron, which is, frankly, sort of crappy, but I'm here on a heroic mission with my trusty crew, C-53.
Heroic feels like an exaggeration.
Okay, sure. And Security Officer Dar.
Plek, don't put me in your stupid recording.
Well, and we're all traveling aboard our trusty starship, the Bargerian Jade. Bargy.
What? Sorry. I'm awake.
It's fine.
I was just flying while asleep.
Hey there, this is Alden Ford. I play Plek, and we are so excited to announce that our podcast, Mission to Zix, is now part of the Maximum Fun Network. Our third season launches on Max Fun on March 20th. Binge seasons 1 and 2 right now. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell-Rorbaugh.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
Now, dear listeners, I do have a confession to make to you guys. We, the four of us who make up this panel, are not perfect. Are we close? Yes. Like, are Alonzo and Dave close to perfect? Yes. But there are things that we cannot do. There are shows and movies that we have not watched, even though we should. So today, each of us was given the responsibility and authority to request that somebody else on this panel watch a movie that came out in the recent past, that's in the buzz, that is respected, but that people haven't gotten to, and to experience it the proper way. And so I asked Margaret Wappler if she would see Can You Ever Forgive Me? By Marielle Heller, starring Melissa McCarthy as Lee Israel, the writer and plagiarist. And so I ask you, Margaret, I mean, you loved this movie, right?
Guy, I did respect your assignment, and I took it on and followed your orders.
That was very diplomatic. I respected your assignment. I feel like AOC just tweeted that.
Yeah, and like a cold diss. I watched it, and I liked it very much. I don't know if I loved it quite as much as I wanted to, but I liked it very much.
I thought that the smooth 90s of it,
yeah,
like the New York it presents is so 90s, and Richard E. Grant's outfits.
Oh.
And everything about him, like, I mean, A, we just have a different pharmaceutical world for gay guys who are HIV positive.
Yeah.
And so presenting that kind of gay guy with a dapper scarf on his head who's a little too thin but who's living his goddamn life,
mm-hmm,
was so evocative. Tell me what you loved and tell me what you didn't love.
Well, I love the milieu of it for sure. I mean, the whole like late 80s, early 90s period of New York is the only New York I'd really ever want to move to.
Yeah.
Like the New York now that exists is just not my jam. But that New York is beautiful and like authentic to me and real, and where it's all just like dive bars and murky
and
streets.
Caton Alley.
Yeah.
And use
that was full Caton Alley right there.
And use bookshops.
And use bookshops. I mean, that was something that was really touching about the film in a way that this, that you could actually make a hustle off of selling letters, forged letters from, you know, the Dorothy Parkers and et cetera that she forged from to antiquarian bookstores, because that just doesn't exist. That, like, market does not exist anymore. You know, in New York and L.A., there's probably, like, two of those places left that would even give a shit about those letters. So there's something just really, like, touching and a throwback to me about that. I also felt like the casting, I mean, what this movie ended up being versus what it was supposed to be is really interesting. Like, you know, the original director was Nicole Holofcener, who was the co-writer of the script, and that would have been just brilliant by me. But then Julianne Moore was first slated to play the Melissa McCarthy role. And I mean, I love Julianne Moore. No one can ever quibble with her abilities, but like, it just would have been such a different beast if she had played it. And I feel like you really needed to have Melissa McCarthy with her like dried out roots and her like slovenly sweaters and her cat dependency and all of the rest of it to
You're
like
describing me.
Well, Karen, did you see the film?
I have not seen it yet, and I should be assigned it next.
There is a deep gayness to it.
Yeah.
You don't get in a lot of movies that attempt to represent homosexual characters, particularly with straight actors. And you know, the fact that you've got Jeff Witte, who is a gay guy who wrote the book of Avenue Q, that is very helpful. But I also just think everyone involved cared, and the fact that this character was given a romantic arc,
yes,
which is not something that like that chubby lesbians in movies traditionally get.
That was lovely.
It was so sweet and heartbreaking.
It's so true. And like Dolly Wells, I didn't like recognize her at first. And, you know, of course, she's like from the HBO show Dolly and
so
M.
So good in this.
Wait, isn't it?
It was Doll and M.
Doll and M, yes. So at first glance, I know what you mean. I just thought she was kind of in it with Emily Blunt, and
yeah,
like, you know, that's great. But
it's
she
not
really
Emily Blunt, but it's the other Emily.
Sorry,
is it Watson?
Mortimer.
Mortimer.
Yeah. Sorry. She's in it with Emily Mortimer, and I thought that they were just pals doing a lark. But at any rate, she really can act, and like she is so just perfect as like a bookstore owner who just is so enamored with this woman that comes in and starts selling these letters and, hey, do you want to read my short story and all of it.
I believed them.
I know. It was just really touching.
There was also something very queer about the idea of this woman is a very capable writer, but is scared to share of herself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And like that's the sort of thing that, again, in like your Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody, nobody's paying attention to how is it different to be a queer person in this world other than they move their wrists different, you know? And it felt like a small movie in its way, but to me it was like such an empowered movie.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there was something too about the friendship between Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy, their characters. It was really like just so warm and lived in. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was no kind of, I mean, the two of them together are just like a real match made in heaven. Like, he almost runs away with the movie, I feel like. Like, almost. You but she's so capable that she drags it right back.
I mean, it's a fag cowboy movie. Like, it's two queers, like, going and breaking some rules and fucking some people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Winter Mitchell.
Can I just, guy, I love this movie so much.
Yeah.
I'm getting emotional with you guys talking about it because I just think that, like, she was so, like, I understood. I understood her.
And I think we...
And she just, like, this notion, like, you're just like, I'm tired of your fucking status quo, but I also got to feed my fucking cat. Like, you know?
We make so many movies about real life people, but that question of, do you understand them? Did you walk away understanding Freddie Mercury better? Did you walk away understanding Don...
I know he had a busy day the day of the Live Aid concert.
Yes.
What was it? The concert?
It was Live Aid. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I know he had a busy day during Live Aid because he had to go out himself to his parents and also be in front of 70,000 people.
And feed 30 cats.
And tell his band he had AIDS.
A lot of cats in this Oscar season. But why do you think this movie managed to connect in a different way?
It's like Margaret Say. It's the milieu of it. I felt comfortable with that. Kate and Ally was one of my favorite shows, and the aesthetic of it, of like, you know, just getting by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Getting by in a way that, you know, we talk about New York in that era. We just talked about Black Monday and everyone was hustling and just trying to, like, you know, make a quick dollar. And she just wanted to stick to what she knew. And even in that moment, and the scene with her and Jane Curtin who plays her agent at the house, is just so, you know, honest and real. And their relationship is honest and real. But it's Melissa McCarthy's. They say in most of the reviews and analysis of the movie is that it talks about depression in a way that isn't often spoken or written about.
The irritable form. Like, she's an irritable bitch. I mean, it's not just the way she is. It's like, that's depression. That's the way it manifests for some people.
The cat poop was so real.
When she's like, the flies. We got to do something about
this. I obviously have to see this film.
No, Karen, best moment is she calls her agent. Agent doesn't take her call. She calls back and says, yeah, it's Nora Ephron. And the agent immediately takes her call. And then at the end, they tell you Nora Ephron had her lawyer send a cease and desist. And any move that can make me think, fuck you, Nora Ephron.
Right. Get a sense of humor.
Karen Tongson, what was your movie?
Well, speaking about working and like the kind of drama of labor and the kind of empathy you feel and the realism that you see around these forms of labor that we don't think about too much. I got Support the Girls. Logan Steiner responded to our Twitter call about this and said, you know, I suppose I should see this film. And I know that, Guy, you brought it up as an all about. Alonzo brought it up as an all about when he visited. And so I was like, okay, this seems right up my alley. Come on, a film about a Hooters-like establishment. I love wings and big-ass beers. And so, and Regina Hall.
And let's be honest, big-ass other things.
Yeah.
And reasonably sized other things.
Reasonably sized many things. And so I watched Support the Girls. Also, because it's getting a new life, I know that it was sort of released simultaneously, distributed in theaters at the same time that it was VOD. So that was something, you know, I wasn't enticed to pay for it at that time, VOD, and I wanted to go see it in the theaters, but, like, you know, there was always something else to see. That's usually what happens in situations like this. That's why we don't see these movies.
Your feminist solidarity is so limited, Tongsa.
Oh, dear goddess. If only everyone knew. Anyway, so it's on Hulu now. So basically everyone can see it. Your kids can see it. And I was I was really taken by the extent to which it is a love letter to real working class people. The working class people who don't have the kinds of jobs that we romanticize as working class, service jobs.
Yeah.
People working in restaurants, people working at malls. And so I found that part of it compelling. Obviously, you know, the film opens with Regina Hall in a crappy car at a crappy mall in Atlanta near the freeway and trying to wipe the tears out of her eyes. But this is where, like, I was like, okay, this is going to be much more fun. It's going to be a romp. This movie was dark.
Yeah.
It was actually kind of depressing. And I was sort of like, there was something kind of histrionic about all of the scenes in the restaurant, like
the rooftop, the bar fight,
they're like having to like soft shoe on the bar to quiet a bunch of dudes who just want to kind of watch a fight and eat wings, like, and at the same time kind of like completely objectifying all the restaurant employees.
You don't say.
You know, and but also, like, I love that at the center, like, as a side character, not at the center, but like really kind of a one of the other beating hearts of the film is Leah Delaria's character.
Yeah.
Who's just like, I know so many random butches like that.
Yes.
Who like hang at the Hooters or who hang at Jumbo's Clown Room or wherever it is where they're just like, that's their bar.
Yeah.
And they go there and, you know, there's a way that you could see that as just like some participation in terrible masculine rituals, but they're kind of there as a protector, an admirer, like also a pal, part of the family.
Well, there is that way, like you're a colleague of them in a weird and different way, because you just don't have the distance of masculinity. But I gotta say two things in defense of this movie. First one is, Karen, you gotta love a good Ulysses, right? You gotta love a good It's Just One Day kind of look at things.
The Odyssey.
Yeah. And like the wry, dark humor of reminding everybody that everybody is complicit in the system, that everybody is manipulating. And we're all, in trying to do the best thing every day, we're all pulling little strings that keep an oppressive system going. It was so harsh, but also so beautiful.
I think
you know?
It was much rawer and realer than I expected it to be. And I think that that's what sort of took me by surprise. And I don't dislike the film. And I just, my whole thing was just that, like, if you're expecting a kind of frothy romp where people are, like, you know, doing car wash gyrations, and you know there are a lot of jokes about wings and mozzarella fries and the whole deal, that's not what you're gonna get.
I don't think we've gotten a comedy that was a car wash romp in that way other than maybe The Favorite in a really long time. You know,
sure.
Like so many comedies. Well, I mean, if to transition a little bit to the movie that I was assigned, it was A Simple Favor, Paul Feig's movie.
Oh, yeah.
With Anna Kendrick.
Talk about a car wash romp.
Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, that was a movie that...
Bake shop romp.
It's basically about two moms of small kids. Blake Lively plays a super sophisticated professional lady who Anna Kendrick becomes friends with, but in a nice, like, single white female lesbian vampiric kind of do I want to steal your life way. And then Blake Lively disappears, and it all starts coming together for Anna Kendrick, or does it? It was so good, it was so arch, but it also had like a darkness to it that, like, when I realized that this was a Paul Feig movie, I was like, that's exciting, but, you know, the guy who's gave us Bridesmaids is now giving us, you know, like...
And The Heat.
These people who are, you know, murdering people and, you know, stealing the husbands of the dead and such.
I think both Winter and I think, wanted you to see this film. And I think I was super surprised you hadn't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Because to me, it just has, like, that... To me, it is a hilarious movie.
Brother
and it's got you, brother fucker.
So
I
good.
Say anything about that, but it lures you in the kind of way that you get lured into things like Gone Girl these days, right? Like that it's got that kind of, you know, sort of flashy kind of mid-level fiction aspect of thing, like, you know, with like the kind of female-driven narrative. But then it goes full-on...
Gillian Flynn just said, fuck you, from Missouri.
You know, it goes full-on shoulder pads, Dietrich looks for Blake Lively.
Yeah.
And you got Anna Kendrick being the best Anna Kendrick she can be.
Yes.
You nailed it.
Which is still 15% annoying. It's one
I was
going to
say, that's sort of my hesitation with this movie, is that I'm just not an Anna Kendrick person.
No.
I think that your hatred for her will actually
help
into
it.
This film.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, it's a wonderful film. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Henry Golding has shown us a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. I want to see it go to the next level because he was sweetened. I mean, both of the movies, both this and Crazy Rich Asians, he is tap dancing backwards and in high heels for somebody else. And I want to see what he gets to do when we let him do a job on his own, you know?
I think he's just hot and maybe not that, like, interesting.
Not that deeper.
But the thing is, it's the terrible thing of being the great Asian hope.
The thing about Henry Golding is that, of course, we want a good Asian himbo.
Yes.
John Cho is not himbo enough. And there are a couple of guys that are, like, kind of made for TV himbo, like Vincent Rodriguez is the third.
Daniel Daquan.
Yeah. But Henry Golding, because of his posh British accent, you expect him to, like, maybe pull some other shit off. But I don't think he's going to do much more than, like, really, like, kind of classy hot guy boyfriend stuff.
Hey, seems like some eye candy.
I'm sorry. He held his own in this movie.
He does hold his own.
He's not designed to be a bigger character than these two women. The battle is between those two characters.
I saw a little more twinkle from him in this than I saw from him in Crazy Rich Asians.
100%.
But this really was. Also, this is the first time I really, like, experienced Blake Lively. And it was delightful.
She's actually, like, quite good.
Yeah,
I have
she's
to
very
say.
Cunning.
Well, and also, like, you know, getting to walk in and have the Joan Crawford role, you know, like, to be the ball-busting, like, career gal, like, that's fun. That's a lot of stuff to chew on. Where I think that Anna Kendrick might be able to go over a hump with her identity. And I will just bring up a point to you guys. My point is this. Amy Adams. We loved her in June Book. Oh, Amy Adams, you're so great. We saw her in Enchanted and we were like, oh, fuck, that's who you are. You are like Lil Ray of Sunshine. And I was like, I'm never going to be able to unsee Enchanted. And she will always just be fucking Ray of Sunshine to me. And now she fucking, like, she, like, pushed through it and we all hated Julia and Julia, but then she came out the other side and is
she's starting to Glenn Close that shit.
She's starting to Glenn Close that
but
shit.
Amy Adams is, like, way better of an actress, just chops wise.
Oh,
Anna
I'm
Kendrick.
Sorry.
Do you want to challenge me on this?
Did you have a Tony nomination when you were 15?
Who gives a shit? She probably bought that on Broadway,
there's
lowered down into Times Square.
Who gives a shit?
Can I whisper a wish for Henry Golding?
Yes.
That I hope that he transforms his solid himbo-ness into something McConaughey or Cooper-esque.
Oh, I'm looking at Denzel Washington PTS. Ooh. BTS, by the way.
BT Dubs.
I'm seeing a Denzel Washington transformation.
I mean, McConaughey grossness off of it. Like, seeing something that lets him be a little bit gross through the dapper.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be lovely.
Yeah.
And Winter Mitchell, what was your movie?
Of course, I get assigned the headiest, most aggressive, longest... Jesus, you guys really treat me like Debbie Matenopoulos, and I won't stand for it much longer. I just won't stand for it much longer.
I'm the joy?
So what? Who cares? I watched Roma.
One of these things is not like the other.
I just, you know, listen, I like high art. I do like amazing movies. I do respect Alfonso Cuarón. I will say that this movie is long AF. I will say that I did not see it on a big screen because who has the time? And I will say that I really appreciated the gravity nod in the movie. The movie is about a housekeeper who works for a more affluent Mexican family in 1971. It takes place in Mexico. And here's what I took away from the movie. The movie attempts to show what I appreciated. You often have films that focus on the drama of the affluent family. Mm-hmm. But we're really seeing what's happening with this housekeeper. And I feel like the character of Cleo is portrayed with so much nuance that it almost put me to sleep. Because her life is something that I've bore witness to just in being, you know, friends with people like this and understanding like what they've gone through. So that wasn't like, you know, brand new or new to me. That wasn't like something that was shocking or, and I'm not trying to be a snob. I'm just saying that part of it wasn't like, oh, okay, this is what happened because this is where she was. What I thought was interesting was how it portrayed Mexico in this era, which is definitely not unlike what's happening right now. And I really thought her performance, her name is Yalitza Aparicio,
Academy Award nominee
Yalitza Aparicio. Her performance was authentic. Mm-hmm. She's never, you know, it took him a year to find the actress to portray this role, but she's so honest. She's so authentic and earnest. And, you know, that part is what makes the movie for me. There were things about the movie that just made me a little annoyed. I didn't realize his sense, you know, that's why I think Gravity, I love Gravity. Gravity is in real time. This is what happens in about 95 minutes. She's lost in space and then makes it to Earth. I cried at the end of Gravity because it's a beautiful scene. And I always said to myself, this is one of the most beautiful end scenes. Her rising from the water and standing there and having made it. I'm again choking up thinking about it. But he hangs on moments in this movie for far too long to make you feel uncomfortable and make you feel everything she's feeling for her. You're doing a lot of work for her, which I don't know if it was because she's a first time actress, because this is what he wanted you to do. But when the boyfriend leaves the theater and you know he's not coming back, when the baby is born and you know the baby's not going to be alive.
Oh, spoiler.
Spoiler, when the baby is born and you know that the baby is going to be stillborn. And the scene before, it wasn't that scene that got me. It was the scene where they're pushing her into, you know, she's trying to get to the hospital and there's a lot of traffic. And then you get to the hospital and she's already sort of in and they hang on. There's so many little subtle references to what we're experiencing now, watching all those ailing, sick, worried people in front of the hospital and seeing the mass of people and seeing the mass of people waiting just to be seen.
The layers of chaos, like just from the way that the house is always torn apart to the tension between the married couple and the way that the blame is being like sloughed off onto her, and that you are just constantly in a state of chaos.
Yeah.
And she's having to keep things going.
Yeah.
I would say what Yalitza does is minimalist, but when you compare it to another movie where nothing happens for an hour and a half and then Glenn Close breaks in The Wife and sort of gives us something, these breaks were smaller, but they were so earned. The stuff that happens in the last half hour of that movie like hit me hard, and I did not cry. I was just sort of like wrapped by what was going on. And then the moment that the plane in that last shot when the plane flies over, like harkening back to when the Professor Zoltan or whatever said, "It looks easy, but can you do it?" about this person who is just carrying laundry upstairs but is also holding a family together and holding a nation together and barely holding herself together.
That's a moment in the movie that I feel like doesn't get talked about enough. This like sort of signal that she's almost supernaturally unflappable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That she can be this caretaker and almost like completely sacrifice herself to like no reward. You know what I mean? Other than like the love of these children, which is valuable, but at the same time, like her whole life is engulfed by that. And it's not always, I mean, I find it really interesting in the movie that it's I still sort of debate it in my mind, like, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, the thing is I don't think that it gives us noble selflessness.
That's my concern. That's why I've been really hesitant to watch it. I'm so grateful for Winter for taking it on.
Debbie Matenopoulos.
No, I mean, I am, because I think that someone suggested that I watch it, and then I was just like, I'll watch something else. but I'm really like afraid of confronting the uncomfortable aspect of it, whether or not it is. I hear from everything I hear that fine line of the fetishizing a kind of noble selflessness or the noble savage motif, and even kind of fetishizing like the nobility of like help.
Yeah.
You know,
like the help.
Yes, exactly.
It's interesting because that's all there and that's all there to grapple with. But then it's true that at the same time, it's a really sort of beautiful portrait of a person, you know, and like I still feel in a certain way like torn up about my own love of the movie because I really gravitated towards it. And I totally understand the like feeling like it's slow and like a punishment. I did see it in the theaters. I did walk into it not knowing at all what it was going to be about, which I think is like a better way to do it in a sense. Like now there's so much hype around it, but like it reminds me of like a really beautiful novel that you keep reading and you're like, I don't know where this is going, and then the last like 50 pages you are bawling your eyes out. Like that's what it reminds me of.
I watched it with a really interesting misconception. I, for some reason, thought it was the same plot as the Nadine Gordimer novel, July's People, where a servant was going to have to sort of, like, take family during time of crisis and, like, protect them in their village or something. I thought I had read that somewhere, and so I was waiting for that to happen, and then I realized, oh, no, it is a much simpler movie than that. But I still love it, and I feel like the movie's effort to explore the spaces that she keeps for herself. Mm-hmm. And like, that was why the subtitle.
I could have used more of that.
The subtitling, but she doesn't have that much of it, you know?
I know, she has like an hour basically after she puts those kids to bed. But she's back in that apartment doing the laundry or whatever.
But I loved the way you like her use of, I think, Mixtec, her native language, and seeing the communication that she did herself, like little boy yelling at her because she wasn't speaking Spanish. It made me understand her world so much. Like, her having the moment where she sang to the little girl in Mixtec, or where she had conversations with the cook, you started to understand how is this person supposed to, like, have a life when she is busy having, depressed professor's life for her. So back in January, our friend Cristela Alonso was here at Maximum Fun talking to the guys on Who Shot Ya about Roma. And here was her reaction to seeing the film.
I have always been taught that people that look like me, like my skin tone and everything, we weren't attractive enough to be on TV, to be in film. We didn't have that, you know, like we didn't look like everybody. And when I saw... when I saw her on the cover of Vogue in Mexico, I was actually really moved in a way that I didn't realize I was going to be moved.
To me, one of the things that like distinguishes this from movies that are sort of like lionizing the nobility of service and selflessness and stuff like that is just the idea of centrality. That like that Cleo is so the heart of this movie, and like... it almost feels like that mom and those kids are never in focus. Like one of my favorite tricks of this movie is that it teaches you the name of the dog Boras early on. So he is, if anything,
a bigger character.
Well, and the character that you are like seeing and understanding this through, and like you understand Boras more than you understand any of those children or even that mom really. Because in doing that, it gives you a sense of what Cleo's life is like. Because her life is way more about picking up that dog shit than it is about where the mom works or what the kids are doing during the day.
Yeah, but I still love that the mom and the housekeeper were fused. You know what I mean? That like Cleo and this woman who works in like the publishing field of Mexico City like still have this relationship. I mean, I think that line that... the mom speaks to her where she says, you know, we're always alone. Women, we're always alone.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the bonding glue between them. You know what I mean? Is that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what class you're part of. It doesn't matter like what you have or what you're born with or whatever. You still may get left by a man.
Well, yeah. And the personlessness of those children is an interesting counterpoint to the help where it's like, oh, Addie was such a great housekeeper because she legitimately loved these children, which I think is a great way of white people being able to center their story in a black person's life. But the fact that...
But not feel guilty about not parenting.
Yeah, like that Cleo, like, just needed to love somebody. Mm. And also, but lived in a world of such economic danger that love presents huge problems. And there was that interesting moment when they are...
Well, loving them was also like her security.
Yeah.
Yeah, her financial security.
But there's that wonderful moment when they are off on that very weird Christmas vacation where she goes down and enters a world of her own class. And that opening up and seeing her open up in that world was very beautiful to me.
Yeah.
Agreed.
What did you guys think of the representations of sort of like race and class in Mexico?
I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for many other people, but I've observed it up close and personal, not only in Mexico, but my mother had a student who took care of us. And just, you know, look, we were not like really rich people and we didn't have any of these experiences that are represented in the film. But just understanding that somebody is from a different place, mm-hmm. and that they have a story and you're curious about them. And, you know, as much as she was curious about us and she knew that in trade that she was learning this language that was going to get her by my mom when we were very young, I learned so much from her. And that's not something that I actually saw represented in the film. I don't feel like those kids felt like they were gaining anything from Cleo, but I felt like the representation of seeing that what she did to take time for herself versus what was going on in the house was so more true to the grain. Like, she didn't really want to drink that mezcal, but it was anything to just feel some community and let some steam out and this just happened to be the place to do it. That was really interesting.
The two best moments with the family are when she is picking up the dishes and half like watching TV because she's getting to, and then sits down and the little boy just sort of like reaches over and embraces her, and mm-hmm. you feel how conditional her place in this house is, mm-hmm. but you also feel that it is the love that she has. Mm-hmm. And then at the fucking end, after like she has walked through hell for them, the little boy saying, "Cleo, can you get me a smoothie?"
Yeah.
And realizing that it bounces off of them and she is having to continue to lead this life that is in different terms than the people who are around her.
Yeah.
That's what scares me about watching this film, because I think, Margaret, when you spoke about it as You're All About a while back when it first came out, I brought up that whole Lola story in The Atlantic. And I think that, you know, for those of you who don't remember, it is about, you know, kind of the forms of indentured servitude that people experience. This was in relation to like kind of Filipinos and a kind of people from the provinces who are taken in by middle-class Filipino families and even moved around and like uprooted from their world. And I had so many vexed feelings about that. And I'm like just a little bit scared. This is part of why I again shunted this off to winter an assignment.
I can understand that, because I do think it's hard. And I could see why, like, anybody who comes from a culture that, you know, uses more like hired help than other cultures, because of course it gets, you know, it's different in all kinds of places, but I feel like all of us, you know what I mean, like I have people watch Silas and I have people clean my house, and like I think it confronts all of us with like what we're doing to sort of sustain our lives, and like, is it ethical and are we paying people fairly and all of these things. And like, I think the parallels that it makes with the Lola story is that in the Lola story, you see that she like literally cannot get medical care for herself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like discussion, you know, there's like points in that article where it's like, oh, her teeth are like in really mm-hmm. bad shape. Mm-hmm. And like the difference, I think, with this story is that like she is actually pretty well cared for. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like there, but it also kind of like wrestles up these feelings of like, but what does that even mean?
It's
very, to be?
Yeah. It's paternalistic.
Like, exactly. Yeah. Like, well, I send her to the doctor. Isn't that good enough? Like, what does that mean in this whole context?
I watched it from a very different perspective because like pretty much the only wage labor that my mom did in her life was either as a cook or some sort of domestic worker. And, like, I just know that she felt on the parallel, on the periphery in so many ways. And I was like, I knew that her, she will never watch it because it's subtitled, but like,
her, real talk.
As somebody who like spent her life, like, the only time people paid her to do something was to watch their children or cook food for them. And that seeing that person presented as a hero and a person of strength, in a way that wasn't cliche, would be like really empowering to her. And you know, it's very different kinds of work, but these are things that we don't give the meaning of narrative. You know, like, there are people who exist on the periphery of narrative and without agency. And like, it is a weird character because she is quiet and she is reactive a lot of the time. But again, I think that last half hour is like just full of power and full of agency. All right. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Listen, we already know that you love genre movies, film craft, and female filmmakers. So, if you love all those things, then by transitive property, you love my podcast, Switchblade Sisters. Hi, I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I have a conversation with a different female filmmaker about their favorite genre film. Each episode covers the filmmaking process, working in the film industry, and just, like, general geeking out about awesome movies. I've had such great guests like the Big Sick writer Emily Gordon.
To me, indie movies as of late have come to be a catch-all term for a movie that kind of defies genre.
Billy Madison and Half-Baked director Tamara Davis.
When a comedian comes and enters onto my set, they're just there to be funny, and we're all ready and waiting for them to be funny.
Horror industry veteran and actor Barbara Crampton.
That's where real drama lies for me. What's between you and I speaking right now? Where are we meeting? And what's the energy that we create between us?
And so many others. So check out Switchblade Sisters every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell-Warba,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? So I turn to you, our dear friend Winter Mitchell, and ask you, what is your current jam?
This is Treasure by Sampha, because it's one of the most beautiful songs, if not the most beautiful song I've ever heard.
Sky shivers, they turn to rain. I turn again, I wish we could heal. I'll take you home, I'll make you whole. You make me wish that this wasn't real.
Because you're... All right, Winter has a birthday to get to, so she's going to leave. But now let me turn to my dear friend Karen Tongson and ask her, what is your current jam?
This is a fun little ditty, and I don't know very much about this band. They're called Sylvan Esso. They're a Durham, North Carolina-based electronic pop duo who actually were already Grammy-nominated for a Best Electronic Dance Album in 2017 for their second album, What Now? Anyway, this just skittered across my Spotify. It's called P-A-R-A-D With Me.
It goes left, nothing there. It goes right, watch your step. It goes left, don't look now. It goes right, loose today. Go ahead, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead. Maybe there's some food up there.
I love a song that has like kind of 80s synthy sounds with vaguely farty noises. And I think that that's what this has. But it's also got that like really kind of contemporary, skippy, jumpy, groovy thing going on. And so in my effort to bring fresher jams to this table, that is my contribution.
I thought it was quite fresh.
Very fresh.
You have anything fresh for us, Mopler?
I do. I have a jam from Maggie Rogers, who made it onto some best of the year kind of lists last year for her song Alaska, which basically got on the map because Pharrell heard it in some kind of NYU class and just freaked out over it.
At the Clive Davis School.
Yeah. And was like, oh my gosh, she's such an individual and like she has such a distinct sound, all of which is true. She has this really like kind of beautiful like neo soul sound, but like filtered through this very like precise pop meets Bjork kind of aesthetic. So here she is singing Alaska.
Moving slowly through westward water, over glacial plains, in a walked off view, in a walked off an old me. Oh me, oh my, I thought it was a dream, so it seems.
She's like so awesome, because and like, you know, I really love the song when it came out on her EP. I think like, I guess like about a year and a half ago, and that EP is very different actually from the album that just came out. It just came out like at the beginning of this year, right? And she's gonna be a big star.
Yeah, the album that just came out is Heard It in a Past Life, and the songs included.
I really enjoyed that, but I worry about any musician who mythologizes the ruralness of their past. I'm always like, when will this turn on me? I went to another musician who was, you know, just toiling away in obscurity. Liam Payne from One Direction.
Those boys are churning out so many songs.
Here's Strip It Down.
People want me for one thing. That's not me. I'm not changing the way that I used to be. I just want to have fun and get rowdy. One Coke and Bacardi. Sipping lightly. When I walk inside the party, girls on me. F1 inside Ferrari. Six kiss me. Girl, I love it when your body grinds on me. Oh, yeah. Baby. Oh. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down for me. Baby. Now there's a lot of people in the crowd, but only you can dance with me. So put your hands on.
Is he trying to Timberlake? Yes. Is he succeeding? No. Do I still like it? Yes. All right, you guys. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Winter Mitchell-Rohrbaugh, and Karen Tongson. Karen, if people were interested in the book Why Karen Carpenter Matters, where could they research more about it?
They can order it anywhere you buy books online right now. You can pre-order it. And it will be at your local special favorite independent bookstore and your big box bookstores coming soon in April.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please come and review us. It keeps Margaret healthy. Right now, she's annoyed but healthy. This week, we would like to thank Enchanting, who said, the Pop Rocket crew seduces you with laughter for the first 15 minutes and helps you grow with a deeper discussion involving pop culture issues until finally they wrap it all up with more laughter. It's good for the soul.
Now,
I hope so. Daniel Sven said, look forward to every episode drop on Friday. I've been listening to the podcast for a while now and always thought Karen Tongson's name and voice were familiar. Finally remembered that she was my professor during my freshman year at USC in 2005 before transferring because I hated LA.
Aww.
She taught a class called Fantastic.
Fanatic.
Oh, Fanatic.
About fan cultures.
Oh, cool. She taught a class called Fanatic. And we read a book about lesbian male impersonators at the turn of the century.
Sounds like my brand.
My final project was on the Victoria's Secret Angels. I got an A. Pop Rocket.
Do you remember it?
Sounds familiar. Yes, yes, of course, Daniel Sven.
Pop Rocket is a lot like that class. Fun, kind of weird, and always informative. Thank you so much.
That's so sweet.
That's wonderful. If you want us to hear your feedback or even ask the panel for advice, you can call 530-237-4108. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. We're joining our Facebook group and get in the discussion. Plus, we got that sweet, sweet Instagram. And what is it called?
Pop Rocket Podcast.
We are a production of MaximumFun.org. Our show is edited by Shayna Deloria, who's going to be leaving us.
No!
Her fellowship here at Maximum Fun is over. We were a big fan of Shayna. She was
a penile sister.
She was so sweet, and she did a good job editing all of our bad.
She's so good at editing
and
the show.
A Shayna Punham. our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who I would humorously call a Miss Kite, but I never would.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.